The Two Divorces. Chapter 14. Thomas More elected chancellor. During all this time, everybody was in commotion at court. Norfolk and Suffolk, at the head of the council, had informed the Star Chamber of the cardinal's disgrace. Henry knew not how to supply his place. Some suggested the Archbishop of Canterbury. The king would not hear of him. Wolsey, says a French writer, had disgusted the king and all England with those subjects of two masters who, almost always, sold one to the other. They preferred a lay minister. I verily believe the priests will never more obtain it, wrote Du Bellay. The name of Sir Thomas More was pronounced. He was a layman, and that quality, which a few years before would, perhaps, have excluded him, was now a recommendation. A breath of Protestantism wafted to the summit of honors one of its greatest enemies. Henry thought that More, placed between the Pope and his sovereign, would decide in favor of the interests of the throne, and of the independence of England. His choice was made. More knew that the cardinal had been thrown aside because he was not a sufficiently docile instrument in the matter of the divorce. The work required of him was contrary to his convictions, but the honor conferred on him was almost unprecedented. Very seldom indeed had the seals been entrusted to a mere knight. He followed the path of ambition and not of duty. He showed, however, in after days that his ambition was of no common sort. It is even probable that, foreseeing the dangers which threatened to destroy the papal power in England, More wished to make an effort to save it. Norfolk installed the new chancellor in the Star Chamber. His Majesty, said the Duke, has not cast his eyes upon the nobility of the blood, but on the worth of the person. He desires to show by this choice that there are among the laity and gentlemen of England men worthy to fill the highest offices in the kingdom, to which, until this hour, bishops and noblemen alone think they have a right. The Reformation, which restored religion to the general body of the church, took away at the same time political power from the clergy. The priests had deprived the people of Christian activity, and the governments of power. The gospel restored to both what the priests had usurped. This result could not but be favorable to the interests of religion. The less cause kings and their subjects have to fear the intrusion of clerical power into the affairs of the world, the more will they yield themselves to the vivifying influence of faith. More lost no time. Never had Lord Chancellor displayed such activity. He rapidly cleared off the cases which were in arrear, and having been installed on the 26th of October, he called on Wolsey's cause on the 28th or 29th. The Crown of England, said the Attorney General, has never acknowledged any superior but God. Now, the said Thomas Wolsey, legate a Latier, has obtained from the Pope certain bulls, by virtue of which he has exercised since the 28th of August 1523 an authority derogatory to His Majesty's power, and to the rights of his courts of justice. The Crown of England cannot be put under the Pope, and we therefore accuse the said legate of having incurred the penalties of praemunire. There can be no doubt that Henry had other reasons for Wolsey's disgrace than those pointed out by the Attorney General, but England had convictions of a higher nature than her sovereign's. Wolsey was regarded as the Pope's accomplice, and this was the cause of the great severity of the public officer and of the people. The cardinal is generally excused by alleging that both king and parliament had ratified the unconstitutional authority with which Rome had invested him. But had not the powers conferred on him by the Pope produced unjustifiable results in a constitutional monarchy? Wolsey, as papal legate, had governed England without a parliament, and, as if the nation had gone back to the reign of John, he had substituted de facto, if not in theory, the monstrous system of the famous Bull Unam Sanctum for the institution of Magna Carta. The king, and even the lords and commons, had connived in vain at these illegalities. The rights of the Constitution of England remained not the less inviolable, and the best of the people had protested against their infringement. And hence it was that Wolsey, conscious of his crime, put himself wholly to the mercy and grace of the king, and his counsel declared his ignorance of the statutes he was said to have infringed. We cannot here allege, as some have done, the prostration of Wolsey's moral powers. He could, even after his fall, reply with energy to Henry VIII. When, for instance, the king sent to demand for the crown his palace of Whitehall, which belonged to the See of York, the cardinal answered, "Show his majesty from me that I must desire him to call to his most gracious remembrance that there is both a heaven and a hell." And when other charges besides those of complicity with the papal aggression were brought against him, he defended himself courageously, as will be afterwards seen. If, therefore, the cardinal did not attempt to justify himself for infringing the rights of the crown, it was because his conscience bade him be silent. He had committed one of the gravest faults of which a statesman can be guilty. Those who have sought to excuse him have not sufficiently borne in mind that, since the Great Charter, opposition to Romish aggression has always characterized the constitution and government of England. Wolsey perfectly recollected this, and this explanation is more honorable to him than that which ascribes his silence to weakness or to cunning. The cardinal was pronounced guilty, and the court passed judgment, that by the statute of praemunire his property was forfeited, and that he might be taken before the king in council. England, by sacrificing a churchman who had placed himself above kings, gave a memorable example of her inflexible opposition to the encroachments of the papacy. Wolsey was confounded, and his troubled imagination conjured up nothing but perils on every side. While More was lending himself to the condemnation of his predecessor, whose friend he had been, another layman of still humbler origin was preparing to defend the cardinal, and by that very act to become the appointed instrument to throw down the convents in England, and to shatter the secular bonds which united this country to the Roman pontiff. On the 1st of November, 2 days after Wolsey's condemnation, one of his officers, with a prayer book in his hand, was leaning against the window in the great hall, apparently absorbed in his devotions. "Good morrow," said Cavendish as he passed him, on his way to the cardinal for his usual morning duties. The person thus addressed raised his head, and the gentleman usher, seeing that his eyes were filled with tears, asked him, "Master Cromwell, is my lord in any danger?" "I think not," replied Cromwell, "but it is hard to lose in a moment the labor of a life. In his master's fall Cromwell foreboded his own." Cavendish endeavored to console him. "God willing, this is my resolution," replied Wolsey's ambitious solicitor. "I intend this afternoon, as soon as my lord has dined, to ride to London, and so go to court, where I will either make or mar before I come back again." At this moment Cavendish was summoned, and he entered the cardinal's chamber. Cromwell, devoured by ambition, had clung to Wolsey's robe in order to attain power, but Wolsey had fallen, and the solicitor, dragged along with him, strove to reach by other means the object of his desires. Cromwell was one of those earnest and vigorous men whom God prepares for critical times. Blessed with a solid judgment and intrepid firmness, he possessed a quality rare in every age, and particularly under Henry VIII, fidelity in misfortune. The ability by which he was distinguished was not at all times without reproach. Success seems to have been his first thought. After dinner Cromwell followed Wolsey into his private room. "My lord, permit me to go to London. I will endeavor to save you." A gleam passed over the cardinal's saddened features. "Leave the room," he said to his attendants. He then had a long private conversation with Cromwell, at the end of which the latter mounted his horse and set out for the capital, riding to the assault of power with the same activity as he had marched to the attack of Rome. He did not hide from himself that it would be difficult to procure access to the king, for certain ecclesiastics, jealous of Wolsey, had spoken against his solicitor at the time of the secularization of he convents, and Henry could not endure him. But Cromwell knew that fortune favors the bold, and carried away by his ambitious dreams he galloped on, saying to himself, "One foot in the stirrup, and my fortune is made." Sir Christopher Hales, a zealous Roman Catholic, entertained a sincere friendship for him, and to this friend Cromwell applied. Hales proceeded immediately to the palace, November 2nd, where he found a numerous company talking about the cardinal's ruin. "There was one of his officers," said Hales, "who would serve your majesty well." "Who is he?" asked Henry. "Cromwell. Do not speak to me of that man, I hate him," replied the king angrily, and upon that all the courtiers chimed in with his majesty's opinion. This opening was not very encouraging, but Lord Russell, Earl of Bedford, advancing to the midst of the group around the king, said boldly, "Permit me, sir, to defend a man to whom I am indebted for my life. When you sent me privately into Italy, your majesty's enemies, having discovered me at Bologna, would have put me to death, had not Thomas Cromwell saved me. Sir, since you have now to do with the Pope, there is no man, I think, in all England who will be fitter for your purpose."
"Indeed," said the king, and after a little reflection he said to Hales,
"Very well then, let your client meet me in Whitehall Gardens." The courtiers and the priests withdrew in great discomfiture.
The interview took place the same day at the appointed spot.
"Sir," said Cromwell to His Majesty, "the Pope refuses your divorce. But why do you ask his consent? Every Englishman is master in his own house, and why should not you be so in England? Ought a foreign prelate to share your power with you? It is true, the bishops make oath to your majesty, but they make another to the Pope immediately after, which absolves them from the former.
Sir, you are but half a king, and we are but half your subjects. This kingdom is a two-headed monster. Will you bear with such an anomaly any longer?
What? Are you not living in an age when Frederick the Wise and other German princes have thrown off the yoke of Rome?
Do likewise, become once more a king, govern your kingdom in concert with your lords and commons. Henceforward let Englishmen alone have anything to say in England. Let not your subjects' money be cast any more into the yawning gulf of the Tiber. Instead of imposing new taxes on the nation, convert to the general good those treasures which have hitherto only served to fat and proud priests and lazy friars. Now is the moment for action. Rely upon your parliament. Proclaim yourself the head of the church in England. Then shall you see an increase of glory to your name, and of prosperity to your people."
Never before had such language been addressed to a king of England. It was not only on account of the divorce that it was necessary to break with Rome. It was, in Cromwell's view, on account of the independence, glory, and prosperity of the monarchy. These considerations appeared more important to Henry than those which had hitherto been laid before him. None of the kings of England had been so well placed as he was to understand them. When a Tudor had succeeded to the Saxon, Norman, and Plantagenet kings, a man of the free race of the Celts had taken on the throne of England the place of princes submissive to the Roman pontiffs. The ancient British church, independent of the papacy, was about to rise again with this new dynasty, and the Celtic race, after 11 centuries of humiliation, to recover its ancient heritage. Undoubtedly, Henry had no recollections of this kind, but he worked in conformity with the peculiar character of his race, without being aware of the instinct which compelled him to act. He felt that a sovereign who submits to the Pope becomes, like King John, his vassal, and now, after having been the second in his realm, he desired to be the first. The king reflected on what Cromwell had said. Astonished and surprised, he sought to understand the new position which his bold adviser had made for him.
"Your proposal pleases me much," he said. "But can you prove what you assert?"
"Certainly," replied this able politician. "I have with me a copy of the oath the bishops make to the Roman pontiff." With these words he drew a paper from his pocket, and placed the oath before the king's eyes. Henry, jealous of his authority even to despotism, was filled with indignation, and felt the necessity of bringing down that foreign authority which dared dispute the power with him, even in his own kingdom. He drew off his ring and gave it to Cromwell, declaring that he took him into his service, and soon after made him a member of his Privy Council. England, we may say, was now virtually emancipated from the papacy. Cromwell had laid the first foundations of his greatness. He had remarked the path his master had followed, and which had led to his ruin, complicity with the Pope. And he hoped to succeed by following the contrary course, namely, by opposing the papacy. He had the king's support, but he wanted more. Possessing a clear and easy style of eloquence, he saw what influence a seat in the great council of the nation would give him. It was somewhat late, for the session began on the next day, November 3rd, but to Cromwell nothing was impossible. The son of his friend, Sir Thomas Rush, had been returned to Parliament, but the young member resigned his seat, and Cromwell was elected in his place. Parliament had not met for 7 years, the kingdom having been governed by a prince of the Roman Church. The reformation of the Church, whose regenerating influence began to be felt already, was about to restore to the nation those ancient liberties of which a cardinal had robbed it, and Henry, being on the point of taking very important resolutions, felt the necessity of drawing nearer to his people. Everything betokened that a good feeling would prevail between the Parliament and the Crown, and that the priests would have a terrible fright. While Henry was preparing to attack the Roman Church and the papal supremacy, the commons were getting ready to war against the numerous abuses with which it had covered England.
"Some even thought," says Tyndale, "that this assembly would reform the church, and that the golden age would come again."
But it was not from acts of Parliament that the Reformation was destined to proceed, but solely from the Word of God. And yet the commons, without touching upon doctrine, were going to do their duty manfully in things within their province,
and the Parliament of 1529 may be regarded, Lord Herbert of Sherbury observes, as the first Protestant Parliament of England. The bishops require excessive fines for the probates of wills, said Tyndall's old friend, Sir Henry Guildford. As testamentary executor to Sir William Compton, I had to pay 1,000 marks sterling. The spiritual men, said another member, would rather see the poor orphans die of hunger than give them the lean cow, the only thing their father left them. Priests, said another, have farms, tanneries, and warehouses all over the country. In short, the clerks take everything from their flocks, and not only give them nothing, but even deny them the word of God. The clergy were in utter consternation. The power of the nation seemed to awaken in this parliament for the sole purpose of attacking the power of the priest. It was important to ward off these blows. The convocation of the province of Canterbury, assembling at Westminster on the 5th of November, thought it their duty, in self-defense, to reform the most crying abuses. It was therefore decreed, on the 12th of November, that the priests should no longer keep shops or taverns, play at dice or other forbidden games, pass the night in suspected places, be present at disreputable shows, go about with sporting dogs, or with hawks, falcons, or other birds of prey, on their first, or, finally, hold suspicious intercourse with women. Penalties were denounced against these various disorders. They were doubled in case of adultery, and still further increased in the case of more abominable impurities. Such were the laws rendered necessary by the manners of the clergy. These measures did not satisfy the commons. Three bills were introduced having reference to the fees on the probate of wills, mortuaries, pluralities, non-residents, and the exercise of secular professions. The destruction of the church is aimed at, exclaimed Bishop Fisher, when these bills were carried to the Lords. And if the church falls, the glory of the kingdom will perish. Lutheranism is making great progress amongst us, and the savage cry that has already echoed in Bohemia, down with the church, is now uttered by the commons. How does that come about? Solely from want of faith. My lords, save your country. Save the church. Sir Thomas Audley, the speaker, with a deputation of 30 members, immediately went to Whitehall. Sir, they said to the king, we are accused of being without faith, and of being almost as bad as the Turks. We demand an apology for such offensive language. Fisher pretended that he only meant to speak of the Bohemians, and the commons, by no means satisfied, zealously went on with their reforms. These the king was resolved to concede, but he determined to take advantage of them to present a bill making over to him all the money borrowed of his subjects. John Petit, one of the members for the city, boldly opposed this demand. I do not know other persons' affairs, he said, and I cannot give what does not belong to me. But as regards myself personally, I give without reserve all that I have lent the king. The royal bill passed, and the satisfied Henry gave his consent to the bills of the commons. Every dispensation coming from Rome, which might be contrary to the statutes, was strictly forbidden. The bishops exclaimed that the commons were becoming schismatical. Disturbances were excited by certain priests, but the clerical agitators were punished, and the people, when they heard of it, were delighted beyond measure.